From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we'll unveil the Great Michigan Read for 2017-2018.
It's a wonderful young adult novel that will appeal to so many folks, young and old.
You know, it speaks to many young people who do not have role models or parents or adults in their lives to guide them and encourage them.
Why women beat the odds to live longer than men.
Society is not really supportive of women as it is for men, but they are living a longer life.
And the Marquette prison hockey team who got to play against Ted Lindsay and the Detroit Red Wings.
So to see Ted up close, they thought he kind of looked like they did. You know, just kind of beat up and weathered.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news.
Mr. Adams, you know, I'd love to have you come back here sometime and play my prisoners in an ice hockey game.
And that invitation from the Marquette prison warden to Red Wings manager Jack Adams led to the Detroit Red Wings' very first outdoor game, playing against Marquette inmates.
Gordie Howe famously said that that was the best ice he had ever skated on his entire career.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, the Detroit Red Wings versus the Marquette prison Pirates. But first, several dozen people turned up at last night's Grand Rapids City Commission meeting asking for changes in police protocol. Their demand came after police held a group of young unarmed black teens at gunpoint last month. Police were responding to a tip that one of the boys had a gun, but there was no gun. The police chief says he has apologized to the boys and their parents, but he insists police followed proper protocol. Chandrika Moore's son was in the group.
What if one of our babies had made the wrong move? And they wouldn't be here with us tonight. Would you be okay with saying that it's proper protocol then?
Allison Kohlberg is executive director of the MICA Center. It's a faith-based justice organization. Allison, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Cynthia. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Allison, you've seen the police body cam footage. So we're talking about five kids aged just 12 to 14 years old?
Yes, that's right.
And what happened when they were stopped?
The police officer whose camera that we watched first got out of the car with his gun pulled, pointed at the young boys and told them to get on the ground. So all the five boys, you know, laid face down on the ground as they were ordered by the police. They really behaved themselves incredibly well throughout this whole situation and should be commended for that. The boys were then asked over the course of the next 10 or 15 minutes, I believe, to stand up one by one and walk backwards to another set of about five police cars where more guns were pointed at them from additional police officers. Stand up, hands behind their head, walk backwards where they were patted down to be checked for weapons. Two of the boys who, quote unquote, fit the description of the person who was supposed to have the gun were handcuffed as well and left in handcuffs actually after being patted down and after it was discovered that they had no weapon. All the boys were put in the back of police cars and waited there until the person who had tipped off the police about the supposed firearm came and confirmed that none of these were the boys that he had seen, supposedly, and the boys were released to their parents.
Certainly, from the sound of Chandrika Moore, there are a lot of very, very deeply felt emotions in the families about this.
Absolutely, and it was quite awful just to watch. I can't imagine what the boys were experiencing. I can't imagine what the mothers were experiencing. And when one of the mothers comes to the scene, you can see she's extremely distraught. She's terrified that her young black son is in an encounter with the police because we've seen this go wrong even when people are unarmed and innocent across the country. And so You can see the fear, you can feel the fear, the terror really that she's experiencing, fearing that her son might already be dead or could end up dead soon if he makes the wrong move, like Chandrika said in that video. And so, you know, in the video, one of the boys, when he gets down on the ground, starts to cry pretty loudly. And you can hear one of his friends say to him, "It's okay, bro, you're not going to die." You know, and his friend doesn't even have to ask him why he's crying. He knows that this boy is afraid that in this encounter with the police, he could die, even though he's unarmed and innocent.
A parent of one of the boys said at last night's commission meeting that relationships between Grand Rapids police and minority communities are, in his words, at a boiling point. What is your view?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, I'm not a member of the Black community. Mm-hmm. So what I can say is that at the commission meeting last night, what I heard absolutely backs up what he said. Many people said this has been happening for years and years and years. We've had conversation after conversation about even cases in this country where people have died. You know, the conversations have been happening. What's lacking now is actual actions to create change that creates an environment where the community actually feels like they can trust the police, like the police are treating everyone equitably and view everybody as equally valuable and equally human. And that is what seems to be not happening. Well, I won't say seems to be. That's what's not happening right now.
So what do you think last night's city commission meeting with people, you know, sharing their views and telling these stories, how will that help to break this cycle of mistrust? Did you hear anything from city officials?
We heard one of the commissioners say that we need to take action. We need to see change. This is past due for all intents and purposes. But generally, there wasn't a strong response from the city commission. You know, the community wants to know, we want to know, where do the commissioners stand? We didn't really hear that from anyone. We do want to know, where do the commissioners stand on this incident, on what needs to happen because of it, and on what the next steps need to be. Mayor Bliss said she assures the community that we're in this together and that we have work to do. And I think we've heard lots of promises, lots of great words about how the community needs change. What we're not seeing is action. And so, for example, there's a 12-point plan that has been developed to address community police relationships and trust. It was developed in 2015 with input from the Urban League, the NAACP, LINC, and started to be put into action. So one of the things that we're asking for is for a community meeting with the police chief and the broader community to give a report out of the progress on those 12 points, which include things like body cams, which has happened, and other things like diversifying hiring practices and bias training and a study of racial profiling and as it relates to traffic stops. And so some of those things are in progress. And there's still a lot of work to do on a lot of those different things. So we want to hear from the police chief in a public meeting how they are doing on these things and what their plans are for next steps to make sure that things are happening, to receive feedback from the community on how they're doing and if the community feels that's good enough.
Allison Kohlberg's the executive director with the MICA Center, a faith-based community justice organization in Grand Rapids. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Allison.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Michigan's Attorney General Bill Schuette is being sued. A group called Progress Michigan has sued the AG after his office rejected their FOIA request for private emails from Schuette and his staff. Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta is here now with more. Rick, what is behind this lawsuit?
Well, what's behind it is the Attorney General's office rejected the Freedom of Information Act request for these private emails, ostensibly because they don't exist. And Progress Michigan, well, they pulled kind of a gotcha and said, actually, they do exist because here are two dozen instances of Bill Schuette and his staff using their private emails for some kind of public, some kind of government business. The Attorney General's office has still not commented on the lawsuit. They say that they're reviewing it. But it does, you know, speak to a wrinkle in the Freedom of Information Act that, you know, we focus a lot on, you know, maybe public officials using public resources for a private purpose. But in the case of the Freedom of Information Act, it actually cuts both ways, that you can't dodge FOIA by simply using your own private account to communicate. If you are using your private email or some kind of private communications mechanism to conduct public business, then that becomes a public record that is subject to open records laws.
So these private emails should be under the purview of the Freedom of Information laws.
What Progress Michigan is saying is that you need to either turn over those emails or you need to explain why you didn't save them because you were supposed to. Remember Hillary Clinton and her private email server and how there was all of this angst over whether or not she was actually turning over all the relevant communications. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of the same thing that if Progress Michigan can show that there are more of these that might exist, then the Attorney General could be in a Hillary Clinton situation of having to explain where are they, what business was conducted, and why didn't you save them?
You've covered the Capitol for a long time, Rick. How common is this, do you think?
I know that it is common for government staffers to be told that, you know, that if you're going to discuss something sensitive, you might want to take it offline. However, if you do that and you get found out, then, you know, you run the risk of getting into trouble over it. You know, in this case, the Attorney General's office said that they, you know, that these emails didn't exist, and Progress Michigan was able to go, well, through other channels, we just happened upon these emails that were private emails that deal with public business. We want to know now how many more are there. And obviously fulfilling, you know, their Michigan, Progress Michigan is a liberal group that exists for the purpose of zinging conservatives and Republicans.
And that's Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief, Rick Pluta. Rick, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up, we announce the Great Michigan Read for 2017-2018.
You know, it speaks to many young people who do not have role models or parents or adults in their lives to guide them and encourage them.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One title, one state, and thousands engaged in literary discussion. That is the motto of the Great Michigan Read. Every other year, the Michigan Humanities Council announces its choice for the Great Michigan Read. It gives us all a chance to connect by reading and talking about this one book. And it is time. It's time to announce the 2017 Great Michigan Read. Shelley Kesprisky is the Executive Director of the Michigan Humanities Council. Welcome to the program, Shelley.
Thank you. We're delighted to be with you.
I cannot believe that it has been 2 years since Stateside had the pleasure of announcing the choice of Emily St. John Mandel's Station 11 as the Great Michigan Read. Where has this time gone?
It's gone so quickly, and what a great book that was.
Before you give us this latest selection, how is the book chosen? Who decides?
Well, it's actually quite an arduous process. We have regional committees that are comprised of various literary folks from around the state. They're regionally focused, and they choose from a selection of books and then come together a few months back in the fall and make a final selection. And it's really done very carefully to ensure that we have a book that will appeal to a wide audience and that it has value that will add to the humanities experience for everyone in Michigan and also will work well for programs that will go on to accompany the novel itself.
Yes, because there's going to be a lot of events going on in conjunction with the Great Michigan Read.
That's right. We host a variety of experiences all across libraries and community centers in Michigan, each unique to that community. So it's a big part of why we choose the novel.
And are we talking about Michigan writers, Michigan subjects? What's the Michigan tie with the Great Michigan Read?
That's a very important point. We always choose a book that has a focus on Michigan, and sometimes the author is actually from Michigan, sometimes not. But the focus has to be around Michigan and issues and cultural aspects that focus on our great state.
So with that, we will do a pretend drum roll, and the 2017-2018 Great Michigan Read is?
X, a novel. This is a wonderful book written by Ilyasa Shabazz, Malcolm X's third daughter, and Kekla Magoon. It's a wonderful young adult novel that will appeal to so many folks, young and old, and will really look at one of the most influential African Americans in history.
People may not realize Malcolm X, before he was Malcolm X, he was Malcolm Little growing up in Lansing.
That's correct. He grew up in this community and had strong ties around the Michigan area, so the novel does address part of his life here in this community.
Spoiler alert, I was privileged to read it over the past weekend, and I have to say, it opened my eyes to so many things, and it takes us from Malcolm's boyhood in Lansing through his years growing up as a street smart teenager, or learning to be street smart in Boston and in Harlem. It hit me in a way I didn't expect.
Indeed. It's a book that some people may have some preconceived notions about, but in fact, when you read it, and it's a quick read, it's an enjoyable, fast read, you see that there's a lot Malcolm X faced as a child and what led to the person he became. And we thought it was a fascinating choice for Great Michigan Read.
What do you hope readers will get from reading X?
Well, we hope that they develop a better understanding of the person that he was and what he became, choices that we make in life, understanding how a prominent figure can really come from a background that may not have been what we all consider leadership material, but indeed does lead us to become leaders. And so I think it speaks to all communities in how we shape young people and what comes out of adversity.
The Great Michigan Read for 2017-2018. It is X, a novel by Ilyasa Shabazz and Kekla Magoon. And you can get all the details on the book and all the activities surrounding the Great Michigan Read by going to michiganhumanities.org. Shelley Kisprisky, always great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now it is a pleasure to welcome the author of the newest Michigan Great Read. She is the third daughter of Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz. She's an activist, a motivational speaker, an educator. And her book, X, a Novel, is the winner of a 2016 NAACP Image Award and now the newest Michigan Great Read. Ilyasa Shabazz, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
How exciting. Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be on the radio with you guys.
And congratulations on your novel being chosen as a Michigan Great Read, because what a great platform for sharing the story of your father's life as a boy and a young man in the state where he was raised.
That's right. And, you know, it's really been such an honor for me to do so.
The world certainly knows who Malcolm X was as an African-American Muslim leader and a human rights activist. But your book is a great reminder there's an important formative life before someone becomes an iconic figure like your father. In this case, Malcolm Little of Lansing. And I bet people have forgotten that your father, many people may have forgotten, your father had very strong Michigan roots.
That's right. And I think a lot of people forget that he was a child before he was this activist, this human rights strategist, and that he spent a significant amount of his time, his childhood, where he got his foundation, the place where he was raised by his parents, right there in the state of Michigan.
So tell us a little about the family, the Little family and their life in Lansing in the 1930s.
My grandfather and my grandmother, they were very young activist parents. And Malcolm was, I believe, their seventh child. You know, they had a very pivotal role in the Marcus Garvey movement during the Jim Crow era, and that was the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And so they were fighting for basic human rights, quality education, quality housing, and it was important for my grandmother to instill specific values of literacy, self-love, compassion, and for my grandfather to instill, you know, specific values in their children. And all of my uncles and aunts said that their father was, you know, to them very much an invincible figure. And so, you know, it was a wonderful childhood. And I say, much like my own, having been raised with five sisters, usually when you have many siblings, you know, it teaches you how to be a good friend. And Malcolm, you know, he had a great sense of humor. They say he was a born leader. You know, he could get anyone in the family to do whatever he wanted. And, you know, so it was a good childhood. It was a good foundation.
But the book does open at a very trying time for the Little family, because Your grandfather had died in what was said to be an accident, but the family believed otherwise.
That's right. This book is for young adults, so it begins with my father's adolescent years, and his father had been killed by the Ku Klux Klan, the Black Legion, which was a splinter group to the Ku Klux Klan. And, you know, just the challenge of all of, you know, the Jim Crow era, his mother was being challenged with raising so many children during the Great Depression.
And then we see him leave Michigan because the options just weren't there. And I think that was really moving, as I read it, to realize what life in Michigan was like for a young Black man in the 1930s and a young man in the 1940s. That there, where could he go? What could he do?
That's right. And I think the biggest blow to Malcolm was being in school and telling his favorite teacher that he wanted to be a lawyer. And, you know, he could have said, I wanted to be a musician. He could have said an athlete, a police officer. But he wanted to be a lawyer because it was how he saw his dad, saving others, helping others. And when his teacher, even after Malcolm being top of his class and being the class president, his teacher told him, well, Malcolm, you have to be realistic. You're nothing but a Negro, and Negroes can only be carpenters and persons using their hands, not their minds. And, you know, you think how crushing that must have been for this young man who didn't have his dad or his mom to say, Malcolm, you know, you're great. You can do anything. Your life matters. There is significance. And, you know, having to put your head down and relocate. You know, it speaks to many young people who do not have role models or parents or adults in their lives to guide them and encourage them, you know, of their value and self-worth. And so Malcolm goes to Boston to live with his older sister from his father's first marriage, and he finds his way in Boston. And so we get to journey along with a young man who is in pain. And I, you know, say that when young people are in pain, they don't say, let me go get a quality education. Oftentimes, you know, they listen to loud music, they drink alcohol, they smoke cigarettes. They make often self-destructive decisions, choices. And so it speaks to the importance of us smart adults, you know, to guide them properly.
Elias, I have to say, you know, when you say that what that teacher said to your father, what he said to Malcolm, who this boy is the top of the class and is told that, and what that does to someone's spirit. And everywhere Malcolm turned as a child and a young man, he was shoved down, and so was his family. And I'm wondering, what was it like for you diving into those very painful times so you could write about them?
Well, you know, there are so many young people who are in these challenging places. And I thought that it was important, you know, so many people look up to my father. And if you can recognize these moments of self-questioning, who am I? What is my value? You know, am I valuable? What is my worth? To think that you are nothing and no one and you can't aspire to be but so much, it hurts. You know, my young nephew, Malcolm, he used to always say to me, Auntie, my life is a lot like my grandfather's life. And I would think, what are you kidding me? But he was right. You know, he was given a very strong foundation and then society beat him down. And if you don't have people to protect you, and oftentimes young people of color, they don't have people to protect them. And so it's a story that's so common, and it was a story that I felt compelled to share.
Did that experience of really digging into his boyhood and his young adult years and writing in the first person, you wrote it in his voice, did that change the way you see him?
You know, it just makes me love him, my father, so much, and appreciate that in spite of the challenges, look how far he went. Look what he was able to accomplish. And so I think, again, that his life serves as such an inspiration. I admire, completely respect, honor everything about my father. And so it makes it easy for me to do the work to make sure that his legacy is properly recorded and also that It serves to inspire so many young people.
Ilyasa, some people might most remember Malcolm X for his white devil remarks and the by any means necessary approach to countering the structural racism in our society. And as incomplete as this image is, because we know his views change, what would you say to people listening who are wondering, why should I read this book?
Well, you know, I mean, let's just be real. Look at the challenges for Black people, you know, when they were brought here. Let's just really look at what was slavery. You know, it was psychologically traumatizing to live your life enslaved for generation upon generation. And to give this shock value, you have a people of color who believed that they were inferior. And then you had white people who believed that they were superior. And so you have, you know, this whole nation, and really not just this nation, but even abroad, being miseducated, being denied opportunity to fully evolve all of your senses. And to have this young man come along and tell Black people who believe that they were nothing, that your life matters, that you have a history in spite of what we had been told for so many centuries, that you have history, that you built the pyramids, that you came from Africa, that it wasn't a jungle, that there was no Tarzan, there needed to be some shock value, but also understanding and recognizing Malcolm's leadership abilities, that he was in his 20s when the world learned of him. He was 39 by the time he was killed. But with all of these challenges against him, Malcolm finding his power, Malcolm finding his leadership, finding his humanity, being compassionate and caring enough to not only read everything that you can imagine so that he could be equipped to educate a miseducated people, but to take on that responsibility. It really says a lot about a young man with all of these obvious challenges in the 1950s and 60s against him. Malcolm was one of the first individuals that introduced a human rights agenda to the civil rights movement. He said, you know, while people were marching and demonstrating, asking to integrate schools and housing, all these different opportunities, privileges, whatever we want to call them, Malcolm came along and said, I demand, we demand our human rights as your brother. And so I think when you put all of that in perspective, that you come to appreciate this very young man in his 20s, in the 50s, who took on this burden. He traveled the world searching for solutions to the human condition that would want to psychologically traumatize or oppress, you know, their fellow brother, sister, child, just because of color.
What do you hope the people who will read this book, Read X, a Novel, because it's a Michigan great read for 2017, yes, 2018, what do you hope they'll gain from that?
Well, I hope that they will find their power, that they'll recognize their humanity, that, you know, the way my mother raised us, which I'm sure was our father's values as well, is that we are all brothers and sisters interconnected under the fatherhood of God, under the fatherhood of our Creator, and that we will be able to see that we're all human beings. And let's live together. Let's work together. Let's cohabitate peacefully.
Ilyasa, before you go, would you read a short passage for us from your book?
Okay. I am my father's son, still and always. He named me, and I will carry the name just as I carry a part of him. What I don't want is the stamp of the white world on me. That I must fight against. Throw off the shackles of past ugliness. Buck myself free. For that, too, is Papa's legacy and something I must carry. I bend down and sign the letter to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X. The guards may come for me, the devil may come, the chains and the darkness, all the wrongs of the world may come, the noose, every force that thirsts for the destruction of the Black man in America. I am my father's son. They will always come for me, but I will never succumb.
Ilyasa Shabazz, along with Kekla Magoon, the author of X, a Novel. It is the story of her father, Malcolm X, focusing on his boyhood and his young adult formative years, and beginning in Lansing when he was Malcolm Little. The Michigan Humanities Council chose this book as the Great Michigan Read for the 2017-2018, and you can get details on the programs set up for this by going to michiganhumanities.org. Ilyasa Shabazz, it was such a pleasure to talk with you today on Stateside. We want to thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you so much, and really, at the end of the day, it's just about self-love and loving others.
More to come. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Who's got more stress, more chronic disease, more anxiety, and more apt to be victims of violence, men or women? Hands down, it's women. So, who lives longer? Women. Dr. Shervin Asari is a research investigator of psychiatry and public health at the University of Michigan, and he has been digging into this question. If men apparently get all the breaks in our society, how come women live longer? Doctor, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
What led you to start investigating this question? What focused you on this?
I was always fascinated by gender differences and how society deals differently with genders, how opportunities are different for genders, and then how these have implications for the health of men and women.
So you started digging around, and what did you find?
The research generally suggests that men live shorter than women. A part of it is sex differences, and a part of it is gender differences.
So we need to understand, when you use those terms, what the different spins are.
Yeah. When we are talking about something which is more biological, it is sex differences, like the testosterone or estrogen or X chromosome. So when it is about genes, it is sex difference. That is not the disparity, because disparity or inequality has an unfairness to it.
Yes.
So when it is designed that way, this is not being considered as a part of disparities. My interest is in the social aspect of it.
When we talk about gender there we go.
Yeah, when so, society comes into the play.
Nature, nurture, we're talking about what we pick up around us, not so much the way we come wired.
Absolutely.
In the United States, what do the numbers tell us as far as life expectancy for women and for men?
It is around 76 for men. And average men, so all collapsed, all races, minorities, everyone. And it is above 81 for women. So around 5 years difference.
And as we said at the top, it's women who tend to have more things stacked against them, such as?
Oh, stress, depression, pay, employment. So even if they are employed, they are earning 80 cents per dollar that men are making. So the society is not really supportive of women as it is for men, but they are living a longer life.
Is some of it the fact that perhaps women will be more likely to go see a doctor for a problem than a man will? Is it behavioral things we're doing?
A part of it is about healthcare utilization. Some of it is rooted in the perception of risk. So women's brain is better designed to understand risk. They are less likely to smoke, not just because they don't like it, because they better understand the risk. Then when they get a symptom, they are more aware of it and they can better communicate about it with the doctor. So they have a higher tendency, they don't see this as a weakness, to go to a doctor or to reach a friend and talk about that condition. They have a better social support, they reach to the doctor, they take care of it, and when they get the prescription, they really adhere to that medication.
So they pay attention to doctor's orders.
Exactly.
So that helps with health. And you certainly say that there are, as far as biology, estrogen versus testosterone, how does that affect our longevity?
In different ways. One, for example, is cholesterol. Testosterone is a predictor of bad cholesterol. Estrogen is a predictor of good cholesterol. This is one issue. The other one is some evidence suggests that testosterone is a predictor of violence against yourself and others. So the people who commit suicide have higher testosterone, so it is a type of violence against self. And those who are a member of gang or get involved in those behaviors have higher testosterone too. A part of it is biology. That's correct.
And to put a button on that point you just made, men are 3 to 5 times more likely than women to die by suicide.
Oh, that is a huge difference. And that is when we can talk about disparities. Because it is interesting that if you study distribution of suicidal ideation, it's women who think more about ideation because they are more stressed, they are more depressed, more anxious, and many other internalizing problems. But when it comes to who gets a weapon and kill himself, it's just men. A chronic condition like cancer is causing very high number of suicides in America by men.
What made you look at this field and start digging into these questions? What's the end game here? What do you hope to really have happen through this research?
What brought me here is that I was always interested in group differences. I am doing some research on black-white differences, on the difference between poor and the rich. Group membership is very interesting for me, that how your phenotype, like being a male or female, works in very complex ways. But what I'm taking this research to is to bring policies or health implications that we can change things to reduce the disparity part.
And what might that be? Are there steps that we can take as a society, policy-wise, that could help raise men's life expectancy?
One issue is that men need more incentives to take care of their health. The healthcare system should be aware of this issue. Men are not perfect healthcare utilizer. They have a masculine role or masculine mask, and they traditionally, many men have defined health behaviors as something that men don't do. So being cognizant of this in the healthcare system, I think, is a step forward.
What about individually, in our homes, in our families? What can we do to give men a shot at the longer lifespan that women have?
Knowing that men are not very good copers, the people who cope with these type of big stress problems, when a major event happens, the person who tends to better cope is the female in the household. So when a diagnosis of cancer is there, as a family, we should be aware that the male person in the family may make bad decisions just because they don't go for solving the problem.
Are there things parents can do as they raise their children?
Yes, some of this is messages that are being shared from very early, from decision to go with pink or blue for your kid to when a kid cries, men up. So the message is that masculinity equals power. And if you don't show toughness, you are not really a man. So that will result in some health problems later.
Doctor, is this the case in all countries where men are favored in the society, yet women live longer? Is that pretty much across the board?
It doesn't have one exception even.
Huh.
So in no country, even there is no difference in the life expectancy. In all countries, women are living longer.
As you look down and want to see what you're going to do with this research, what further questions does your research raise in your mind?
You know, it's not just gender in our society. It is the intersection of gender and race and social class and many others. The life that a black male is living these days in the United States, a life that a white male is living like compared to Arab American male. Just a few days ago, I published one paper showing that stress is a better predictor of depression among men. So if stress happens, who is going to be more depressed? Men, not women. And if they are equally discriminated, who is going to be distressed? Men, not women. So I am combining the idea of gender, race, and social class for my research to better understand the intersection of all these constructs.
Certainly food for thought. Dr. Shervin Asari is a research investigator of psychiatry and public health at the University of Michigan. And if you go to theconversation.com, you'll find his piece, If Men Are Favored in Our Society, Why Do They Die Younger Than Women? Thanks so much for being with us, Doctor.
My pleasure.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers there reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
Time again to talk about our state's history with the help of our partners at the Michigan History Center. You have most likely heard that the Detroit Red Wings played their final game at Joe Louis Arena this past Sunday. But did you know that the Detroit Red Wings' very first outdoor game wasn't at a stadium or even in a big city? It was at the self-proclaimed Alcatraz of the North. Joining us now are the Michigan History Center's Mark Harvey and former sports writer for the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit Red Wings and current Novi Community Schools communication specialist, Bill Roos. Good to have you both with us.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Bill, I want to set the stage here. Here we're talking the 1950s, and the Detroit Red Wings were really at the height of the Gordie Howe glory days, winning that string of Stanley Cups. So what happened in the offseason? They marched the players out for a media campaign?
Yeah, a lot of times in the off seasons, what they would do to satisfy advertisers on the radio during the season, they would go out on barnstorming trips. And this particular time, it was general manager Jack Adams and terrible Ted Lindsay went up to the UP.
And so what happened when they had that visit in the UP?
Well, they were up there for the Stroh Brewing Company, and they visited Marquette and went into the prison where they were met by the warden, and they got a tour of the place and met some of the inmates, many of whom quite notorious, were from Detroit in the Purple Gang, if you're familiar with them. They were in there for some hard time, some nasty crimes, some murders, and a lot of bootlegging. And so these guys, they were the toughest of the tough, and that place was called Alcatraz of the North for obvious reasons.
Mark, Marquette, as we just heard, the Alcatraz of the North, give us an idea of what were conditions like in the mid-50s.
Marquette was built in 1889, so it was this Victorian fortress. When you drive up the drive, you're met by this castle-like structure. It was meant to be imposing, and it was. I've visited there myself. Even when you're not supposed to be in there, you just don't want to be there. And cells were small. They do not have toilet facilities in the cells. They were cramped. In some recounts, it was said the wardens wouldn't issue long underwear during the frigid winters, just because if someone escaped, they didn't want them to be too comfortable out there in the UP woods.
Tough place. So where did this idea of a game begin, Bill?
Well, it was on that trip in the summer of 53, and the warden, Emery Jacques, had said as the Wings were leaving, "Mr. Adams, you know, I'd love to have you come back here sometime and play my prisoners in an ice hockey game." And really at that time, according to Ted Lindsay, Jack kind of dusted it off as if, you know, yeah, sure, it was just pleasantries and, hey, thanks for having us. He never thought he'd hear him again. He goes, "No, but really, we would love to have you guys up here." And so Jack kind of played along and said, "Listen, if you pay for our airfare, you put us up, we'll more than gladly come up and play you guys during the season." Lo and behold, a couple months later, the warden calls Jack Adams up and says, "Guess what? We're all lined up. We can bring you guys up." And so Jack really had no other way out of this. He made a promise to him if he came through, and he did. So the Wings marched up there. They had a three-day break in between games. It was February 2nd, and they had just come back from Chicago, and they went up to Marquette, the whole team. Now, some of them were a little apprehensive. Red Kelly had told me that he wasn't thrilled about going up there. Like Mark talks about how imposing the prison was, he says his knees were knocking as they were coming up to the prison. Ted was a tough guy. I mean, Ted wasn't bothered by it. Matter of fact, on the trip prior, Ted had his picture taken with his fake prison ID, and you know, he just kind of reveled in the whole idea. Plus, the prisoners loved Ted because Ted led the league in penalty minutes. Ted, you know, they call him Terrible Ted for a reason. Yeah. If you ever saw him up close and the countless scars on his face, those guys loved this. He was a hero. You know, a lot of them had never met these people. It wasn't like today with the internet and every game being televised. They heard games on radio and they read accounts in the newspapers. So to see Ted up close, they thought he kind of looked like they did. You know, just kind of beat up and weathered.
And a fighter. Mark, you came across some information that kind of hints there might be another twist or an added twist to the story of how this game came to be.
The other important thing to remember is that this wasn't the Department of Corrections sponsoring this game. In fact, once the warden, you know, put the invitation out there and it was accepted, he took that to heart and was a little afraid of what he had just promised to do. So he had to quickly scramble and connect with the local Marquette Sentinels semi-pro team, get the business leaders in the community to help raise those funds to get the team up there. So part of that three-day trip, they did play the prison game first, and then that same evening, and again, this doesn't usually happen nowadays in professional sports, they had dinner at the prison, went back to their hotel, and then showed up for an evening game with the Marquette Sentinels.
Something tells me that the Alcatraz of the North, Marquette Prison, did not come equipped with a hockey rink. So, Bill, how did this thing all come together?
Well, the prison had a director of physical activities. His name was Oki Brum. And Oki was a former University of Michigan hockey player. When this whole idea came about, he was kind of tasked with the duties of putting this rink together with a lot of material that would have otherwise been thought of as being used to escape such a place. Mm-hmm. And so he couldn't use a lot of inmates to help them, not until a lot of the boards and a lot of the infrastructure was already in place. So there was a lot of concern about who he could use to help put this rink together. But once he put that rink together and the Wings stepped on that ice, Gordie Howe famously said that that was the best ice he had ever skated on his entire career.
Wow. So they did a great job. So game day arrives, and I love the name, the Marquette Prison Pirates. Were they able to keep up with the likes of Terry Sawchuk and Gordie Howe and Ted Lindsay?
Well, I'm going to guess that your guess would be no, and you would be correct.
I would guess no.
Yeah. According to Ted, the score was 18-0 after the first period. But everyone was having such a fun time that they just kind of switched jerseys. There was a prisoner ended up being a centerman between Gordie and Ted. And Terry Sawchuk joined the Prison Pirates team, put on their jersey, and went into their goal. So it was just a fun afternoon after that. And after the 18-0 first period, nobody continued to keep score.
Just let's have fun. Mark, you found some records that perhaps point to a little maybe gamesmanship from the warden?
Yeah, there's day books that are filled out by the warden in their office, and we have no real proof, but there's some suspicious transfers prior to the game, and then the same prisoners go back out. The other thing that's really funny is that there's a lot of prisoners that were coming up for parole, and they just didn't want to get paroled before this game. You know, this was the highlight of the year or years of these people being here, and so they didn't want to miss it by, you know, something silly like getting freed. So they're trying to figure out how to not get paroled but not be there for years further. So
kind of stacking things a little bit there.
Yeah, and I think another fun tidbit is that after the game, the Prisoner Pirates became to be known as Emery's Boys, named after the warden.
Oh, boy. I just love it. And I'm interested, Bill, as you talked to Ted Lindsay about that game, what did they think about it in hindsight? What did the players think about that whole thing? I mean, you had some players saying their knees were knocking as they walked into Marquette.
Yeah, well, like Red Kelly was worried because he remembered murders that had taken place not far from Ma Shaw's place off of Grand River. And those were committed by Purple Gang members that he knew were now imprisoned up in Marquette. So he had a real phobia about that. But afterwards, talking to him and Ted both, everybody won. They loved the fact that these guys just came out as perfect gentlemen, as Ted described them. They all respected the game, and everyone, like I said, everyone just had a lot of fun that afternoon.
As an odd postscript to the end of the game, here are the Stanley Cup champions, mm-hmm. and after they won, they were brought to center ice, and they were presented with the prison's version of the Stanley Cup, which was called the Honey Bucket, which was a mm-hmm. chamber pot. They also were each gifted a hand-tooled leather wallet with the winged wheel logo on it that the Prisoner Arts Department had made for them.
This is an awesome story. The Wings' very first outdoor game in prison at Marquette. Thank you so much for sharing this story with us, Mark Harvey with the Michigan History Center and former sports writer for the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit Red Wings, Bill Roos.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you very much.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.